go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! This may come as a great surprise to some of you, but last night, after I shut down the horn section, and after I got the rerun stream going, and after opening in rapid succession several various and sundry bottles of fermented comestibles, I had a revelation. It was after midnight, and I have returned to the faith of my fathers. Yes, I have. It all makes sense to me now. It came to me in bright lights and revelation, and it seemed as though the very bed itself were spinning when I realized that crackers do turn into meat in one's belly, and it's holy meat at that. And that wine turns into blood and snakes talk. I am back in the bosom of the faith of my fathers. I hope John McCain won't sue me for using that phrase, considering it's the title of his autobiography as well. But I am comforted. I am comforted amid the buffeting winds of change that blow across this nation, this great, great nation, this nation founded upon principles of Judeo-Christian ethics, this nation founded by great men who understood the value of the Ten Commandments, who founded this nation itself upon those very Ten Commandments. I am uplifted, O Lord, yes. April Fool. There, that's enough of that. I can't do it. I can't do it. There's too much incredibly serious stuff out there that if I was to try to mean up and take the right-wing position on it, I couldn't live with that, with myself. And no, I didn't have the bed spins last night either. The day I get the bed spins on one bottle of Corona, well, that's the day that becomes the last bottle of Corona, so, you know. Happy April Fool's Day to everyone. And what is the history, just out of curiosity, what is the history of April Fool's Day? Where did it come from? What is its meaning? Well, we're about to find out. According to that not exactly incredibly accurate Wikipedia, its origins are shrouded, shall we say, in the mists of time. Wikipedia claiming that it's likely a relic of the once common festivities held on the vernal equinox, which began on March 25th, the old New Year's Day. Why is that the old New Year's Day? I would really like for that to be the new New Year's Day. January 1st for New Year's Day just bites. It has antiquated roots in Great Britain, a celebration on April 1st. But April Fool's, as we understand it, began in the 18th century in, of course, my native land. The land of my fathers, Scotland, where the custom was known as, hunting the gawk, otherwise known as the cuckoo. Well, how about that? It says the cuckoo was a term of contempt. Well, you know, he's gone cuckoo, that kind of thing. But hunting the gawk, hunting the cuckoo, in light of the fact that most of the people who settled the American South were of Scots or Scots-Irish origin, could that be where snipe hunting comes from? Because a lot of boys who grew up in the American South got a certain form, kind of a baptism the first time they got taken out snipe hunting. Snipe, 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 snipe! But anyway, whatever it is, this is April Fool's Day, and Mark Levine just did a beautiful, beautiful job April fooling around with Mike Lane. Although I got to tell you, Mike Lane sounds more sensible in that guise than he ever has in the rest of his poor misbegotten life. Apparently, his vision of being a liberal is to be a stoner. Dude, I'm a liberal. Hey, pass the Cheetos. But it's not really like that. Of course, you know that because you're liberal and you're probably not a stoner. Some are, some aren't, but the vast majority of liberals I know aren't just, you know, liberals because they're stoned or whacked or high or drunk or... Mark did a lovely job. I gave long and hard thought to it, and I thought, you know... Yeah, I could do this for 3 hours. But you know what? 3 hours of meanness isn't good for your soul. You know, I had a professor once who said the problem with being a devil's advocate is that sooner or later you begin to resemble your client. And there's truth in that. So we'll just say that we've done... We've done our April Fool's Day deed. The idea, I'll probably have to go back into therapy just at the very thought of accepting all the bunkum and hokum and crazy insane crap that they babble about in the Southern Baptist Church. The idea of going back to that. But I'll try not to have to deal with that until the show is, like, you know, over. A very dear friend of mine, this is her birthday. So a very happy birthday to you, and you know who you are. How can you forget somebody whose birthday is April Fool's Day? It's not possible. But anyway, happy birthday. So, down to business. A particular update for you. I want to share a little basic information with you. We've talked a little bit about the family of Debbie Shank. She's from Indiana. She worked nights stocking shelves at Walmart until a semi-tractor trailer slammed into her and changed her life forever. The insurance on the trucking company was only for $1 million. And they got that, and the lawyer got his fee, and I certainly am not going to gripe about the lawyer's fee, because in contingent fee situations, the lawyer takes all the risk and only gets paid if the lawyer is successful on behalf of the client, so no problem there. But this is a letter from Deborah Shank's other son. See, there was a son who was killed in Iraq about 6 days after they... lost the trial to Walmart that took away all their money, all her money. So that, as has been noted ever since then, every time she asks about her son, they have to tell her that he's dead, that he was killed in Iraq. And for her, it's like learning it for the first time all over again. She lives in a sort of Groundhog Day hell. Well, her other son has sent a note to Walmart Watch, and that's walmartwatch.com, And he said, first of all, let it be known that I'm Debbie Shank's son and not some random dude putting in his 2 cents. That being said, here's the skinny. When we sued the trucking company, our lawyer told us that the only amount we could get off of the trucking company was what the truck was insured for, namely $1 million. As they were a small trucking company, they had no real net worth, and the amount we could sue them for was just their insurance. When we received the settlement of $1 million, a third of that was paid out to the lawyers. After that, my dad was given a portion of that to make up for lost wages. We told Walmart about all of this, and they basically said, okay, and did nothing. We set up the rest, $417,000, to take care of Mom. We took care of her for 3 years on that, but when the statute of limitations was set to expire on Walmart suing us, they literally had days left. They filed to sue us. Our lawyer told us at the time that they were only doing this to keep their options open, but Walmart decided that they wanted to go after the settlement, as they say time and time again, quote, out of fairness for everyone on the medical plan. And so it went. The first ruling came August 31st, 2006. At the time, it was the worst thing that had happened. 6 days later, my brother was killed. Dad said, fine, whatever, they won. We were without any will to keep on going. Our lawyer said, we'll appeal. You just don't worry about things. We'll take care of all of it. Appeal after appeal, Walmart won them all. We finally appealed to the Supreme Court. Last week they said they weren't going to take our case. We lost. Now Walmart can't take any more money than we had in the trust fund, so they get that. But we still have $150,000 in outstanding medical bills. We have a fund set up that has accepted donations, but it quickly depletes due to bills. Even with government assistance, we still must pay anywhere from $500 to $1,000 a month to keep Mom in the nursing home. And that's not counting bills she has from trips to the hospital. A couple of weeks ago, she was bleeding internally. The outstanding bills we have, they can sue my father directly on. So it's looking like he may have to sell his home, at least. My youngest brother, if he wants to have the money to go to college, will himself either have to take out thousands in loans or join the military. Dad has worked all his life, was set to retire in 5 years, but now it's looking as if he'll have to work longer and longer. Plus, he has cancer to worry about. So that's the story. I have a feeling that somewhere along the lines, be it by Walmart, the courts, the lawyers, the trucking company, or a combination of all, we've been taken advantage of. We could only sue for so much. We had to pay the lawyers. The courts decided to maintain the status quo, and Walmart sold its soul. Whoever's fault it is, we're screwed, plain and simple. It's that last part that I'd like to address. Of all the people, all the parties that he listed who may potentially have, in combination or alone, screwed them, the courts, the lawyers, the trucking company, or a combination of all, he did not name the one party, the one group, that has done him and his family and so many millions of other families so much harm. I'm talking, of course, about the Republican Party, the grand old party, the party whose conservatives have hoodooed and hokumed and buncoed the American working population, the working people of America, regardless of race, creed, or color, into thinking that right-wing conservatism is somehow an affirmation of their viability and worth as human beings. Because, you see, it's Republicans and their enablers, like the United States Chamber of Commerce, who spend every waking hour, every instant of every day, every electron firing between the synapses of their neurons in their brains, who spend every iota iota of all of it trying to figure out a way to take a little bit more from people who every day have a little bit less to be taken. It's right to work laws. It's tort reform. Why do you suppose they could only get the $1 million from the trucking company? Was it a bad lawyer? No! They live in Indiana! They live in Indiana, a judicial hellhole for the ordinary people who live there. It's not that hard to figure out. They live in a place that has been controlled by Republicans for so long that most of the people there have forgotten. Sorry, Poppy. Most of the people who live there have forgotten what it's like to actually be represented by elected officials. Republicans, you know this, spend their time talking about that woman who ripped off McDonald's by suing them for $1 billion when the stupid old lady burned herself with some coffee. Night and day they go at this stuff, hammer and tongs. All aimed at making sure that justice, so to speak, inures to corporations and not to we, the people. No, Monique, West Virginia is not a red state. We have a Democratic legislature. We have a Democratic Senate. We have a Democratic governor. We have two Democratic senators, and two out of three of our representatives in Congress are Democratic. Mostly we've been able to fend off a lot of this BS here. But not all of it. Not all of it. You want to know why an evil practice like subrogation exists? Subrogation is the term for what Walmart exercised against the Shanks family. Subrogation exists because insurance companies have more power over legislatures and court systems than people do, than voters do. Come on, let's be honest. Subrogation means that an insurance company that is honor-bound and duty-bound to pay medical bills, that an insurance company, well, so what? Well, I mean, we paid them and everything. Well, we want your money now. What? You sued somebody and you got a settlement to take care of you for the rest of your life? No, give it to us! We want the money! Give us the money! The money is ours. It should be ours. That's what they do. Insurance companies drink money like vampires drink blood. And the last I checked, vampires aren't very discriminating in where the blood comes from. If it's a slow night, you know, a vampire will go down in the alley and suck the blood out of a rat. Doesn't matter. But that's subrogation. And subrogation exists because governments let it exist. That's a function of government as well. That's a function of the judiciary. You know, we got some bankruptcy reform crammed down our throats a few years ago, but you'll notice they didn't reform the bankruptcy rules so that corporations who are sued can't just declare bankruptcy and walk away from a judgment. No. Corporate America didn't get reformed. You got reformed. I got reformed. Everybody with credit card debt got reformed. Dirty, rotten bastards. And, you know, I'm not, please, don't think that I'm gooning on Mr. Shanks. I'm not. But Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, he's got to understand where the problem begins. And it doesn't begin at a trucking company with a negligent driver. It doesn't begin, as badly as I loathe them, with Walmart. Walmart was doing what the law permitted it to do. which is all a corporation is bound to do. There, you might, you know, sit down and hear somebody from, you know, the Harvard School of Business talk about business ethics. Jesus, corporate ethics should be a class that, let's see, how long does it take me to say this? There ain't none! It's a 3-second class. Corporations are in the profit business. Corporations are in the business of making a profit for their shareholders. That is the only duty they have. The laws of most states say that that duty is fiduciary in nature, which means that that duty has really, really high standards attached to it. The board of directors and the officers of a corporation bear a fiduciary duty, the highest level of trust to shareholders to do one thing, and that's bring in profit, baby. Doesn't matter who gets polluted, whose land gets raped, whose air gets fouled, whose water gets skanked. Doesn't matter whose ox gets gored or whose mama gets her nursing home money taken away from her. Corporations exist to do one thing, profit. And all of this problem has been caused by a variety of people. It starts with the negligent operator of the semi-tractor trailer truck. It goes through the trucking company that had a BS little $1 million policy when they should darn well know that any damage they caused could well exceed $1 million. They were deliberately underinsured. It flows into Walmart with insurance companies. Yes, I know Walmart's yielded. You're spoiling my story. I'm getting somewhere here. Walmart demanded subrogation because Walmart is legally allowed to demand subrogation. But at the end of the day, every last vile part of this story has a taproot sunk deep into the Republican politics of hate and disdain and disrespect and outright loathing for the people who get up every day and march out the door and carry this country on their backs and pay the debts of people at Walmart and Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs and GE and Halliburton and Enron and Kellogg Brown and Root and on and on and on and on and on. Now, Walmart has knuckled under. Walmart, because of the efforts of, I dare humbly suggest, people like me, people like you, people who have written to Walmart, called Walmart locally or in Bentonville, Arkansas, people who have called their the elected representatives about this, people like WalmartWatch.com and David Nasser there, people like Keith Olbermann, who swore that he would keep hammering away at Walmart every night until they did the right thing. Well, that didn't last long. Headline, Walmart drops injured worker claim. Associated Press reporting, Walmart has dropped the $400,000 reimbursement claim. Well, that's a lie to begin with because they sued for $470 million out of the $470,000 out of the $415,000 that the Shankses still had. The Associated Press claiming in its lead, Walmart Stores, Inc. is dropping a controversial effort to collect over $400,000 in health care reimbursement from a former employee who was confined to a southeast Missouri nursing home since she suffered brain damage in a traffic accident. The world's largest retailer said Tuesday in a letter to the family of Deborah Shank it will not seek to collect money the Shanks won in an injury lawsuit and against a trucking company for the accident. May I suggest to the Shankses a little bit of caution? Walmart has a judgment against you, and you are not safe, Shankses, until such time as Walmart delivers to you a signed, sealed, filed with the court release of that judgment. Up until then, Pharaoh's heart can harden and he can turn his face from the ways of righteousness. The article reports Walmart's been roundly criticized in newspaper editorials, on cable news shows, and by its union foes for its claim to the funds. Now let's talk about this for a minute. Let's figure out why this is the way it is. What did I say earlier? The fiduciary duty that is owed by corporate officers and corporate board members to the shareholders is one of money. Always, always, always seeking to get more money for the shareholders. Up until they made this decision, their position was that this was a subrogation clause that was in the health care package for all Walmart workers who had health care, that minority of Walmart workers, and that to single out the Shanks family would make them unable to pursue subrogation against anyone else, which would therefore be deleterious to their health care plan, which would then be a breach of their fiduciary duty to their shareholders. As you can see from the fact that the Shanks has lost every blessed appeal they took all the way to the Supreme Court, who refused to hear the case, Walmart was on rock-solid legal ground. However, and this is the portrait in the effectiveness of individual activism. However, when everyone in the United States began to turn a jaundiced eye upon Walmart for their treatment of the Shanks family, the directors and the officers of Walmart had to re-examine their position. Why? Because to continue to pursue their position against the Shanks family was doing manifest harm to the so-called good business name of Walmart. And all of that negative publicity could in turn result in a net loss of share value. And a position that resulted in a net loss of share value would then be, at least arguably, a breach of that board and those officers' fiduciary duty to the shareholders of Walmart. And when they crossed that barrier, when public opinion and public pressure rose to such a pitch, then and only then could Walmart do the human thing as opposed to the fiduciary corporate thing. Okay? So please understand, the fact that Walmart has backed off this claim is not an indication that somewhere along the way, Walmart, like something from How the Grinch Stole Christmas, that their heart suddenly grew 10 times plus 2. It didn't. The entirety of corporate America, as it currently stands, is dictated by a single line from the Godfather, Abe Vigoda. Tell Michael I always liked him. It was only business. Tell the Shankses we always liked them. It was only business. Ken Lay. Tell the people who don't have pensions anymore we always liked them. It was only business.
The Bush administration.
Tell the 4,000 grieving families of the soldiers who've died in Iraq that we always liked them. It was only business.
Business has no ethics. If you hear business as ethics or corporate and ethics back to back, you know that you're talking about something that has no relationship to any concept whatsoever of right and wrong. Because the only consideration is profit. Am I saying profit is bad? No, I am not. Not at all. For instance, just as a for instance, March is over. We just finished in a $400 hole here at the Horn. That $400 hole followed on the heels of, I think, a $100 hole. The $100 hole followed on the heels of a $500 hole. And we operate perpetually in the red. If we were a publicly traded corporation, the people running the Horn would have been dragged out into the streets and thrown out of their positions by now. We are not public. We are not a publicly traded corporation. We are also not making a profit. Not only are we not making a profit, we're not making the bills. But that's okay. April is another month. And here's hoping to God that it's not a T.S. Eliot kind of month, and I wind up on April 30th saying, well, you know, just like T.S. Eliot said, April is the cruelest month. But that's just by way of example. Profit is not bad. Profit is good. Profit is good when it serves the aims of the company and allows the people working for the company to do better. Profit, however, is bad and excessive when the drive for it is used to pervert governmental and judicial processes, to undermine the work regulations, to undermine governmental regulations that protect the markets themselves, as we saw yesterday. When profit... But then again, I just told you, profit is all there is in corporate America. You know, shareholders, this is, you might find this interesting, but I think it was 1919 when shareholders of Ford Motor Company sued Henry Ford and won. You know about this? Henry Ford had instituted a new, brand spanking new, forward-looking minimum wage for every worker of the Ford Motor Company of $5 a day. Nobody that worked for Ford would make less than $5 a day in 1919. The shareholders of Ford Motor Company sued Henry Ford personally for diminishing their profits at the expense of his newfangled minimum wage. The shareholders won. And the court said something to the effect of, no matter the altruism behind Mr. Ford's motive, his sole and only obligation is to maximize the profits to the shareholders of the Ford Motor Company, and the minimum wage was struck down. I mean, if you think corporate cronyism and corporate oligarchy are new in America, Well, you must be kind of new to the game. Not long after that 1919 court decision, Silent Cal, Calvin Coolidge, as I have referenced on a number of occasions, told the world that the business of America is business. If it is not nailed down in this country, we'll sell it. Because there's somebody we know that wants to buy it. As far as I'm concerned, you can take all this E Pluribus Unum and Novus Ordo Seclorum and In God We Trust off the money, and you can replace it with that most seminal statement by Calvin Coolidge, because it makes a hell of a lot more sense on the money than any In God We Trust when you consider what our money does. Far better that we should just imprint all the money with "The business of America is business." Why do you think there are more business majors in colleges today than there are math majors or physics majors or chemistry majors or English majors combined? Why do you think one of the most precious sheepskins you can own in this country today is a Master's of Business Administration from Harvard? Because the business of America is business. Do you take any issue with anything I've said? If so, what? Now, the question, is how one fixes a situation like that. And I'll be honest, I don't have the answer. Because it is so deeply ingrained in our culture that I sometimes think you would have to take the whole thing apart and just rebuild it from the ground up to fix it. Can you ingrain honest-to-God morals or ethics inside the fiduciary duty of a board member or a corporate officer? And as is, and I apply the same test to this matter as I would apply it to the right-wingers who want to teach Judeo-Christian ethics in the schools. Whose Judeo-Christian ethics? Whose prayer are you going to pray? Whose ethics are you going to impose upon corporate America? I don't think you can. And that's why it becomes important to realize that perhaps the only solution to all of this is to take away the civil rights of corporate America. That sounds brutal, but since when is a corporation a flesh and blood person? We've talked about it before. Up until the court case of, 1884, 1886, Santa Clara versus Union Pacific, or Union Pacific versus Santa Clara, whatever the hell it was, it was assumed that the rights in the Bill of Rights were human rights. After that, they become civil rights. Might that be a starting place? Redefining American rights as human rights? It's worth thinking about. Truly it is. Take a break and come back. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. Or, if you've got your own long-distance dialing plan that's unlimited and doesn't cost you anything, 304-658-3333. Email rolls into bob@headonradio.com. You know all of that. So we'll take a little musical interlude, and we'll come back in a couple of minutes. This is The Horn, America's liberal voice, listener-supported. I'm Bob.
Well, I had just got out from the county prison doing 90 days for non-support. Tried to find me an executive position, but no matter how smooth I talk, they wouldn't listen to the fact that I was a genius. The man said we got all that we can use. Now I got them steadily depressing, low down mind messing. He should be smoking on a big cigar. But till I get myself straight, I guess I'll just have to wait in my rubber suit to rub on these cars. Well, all I can do is to shake my head. You might not believe that it's true. But working at the end on Niagara Falls is a undiscovered Howard Hughes. So baby, don't expect to see me with no double mark.
That was just too easy. And, yeah, sure, any opportunity to run a little Jim Croce, why not? Bless his soul. This in from our pal Marty. What's a capitalist? A capitalist is someone who will gladly sell you the rope you're going to hang him with. My fellow at the time computer science majors always did opine that the business major was the root of all evil in the universe. I inserted the word evil because I think Marty just left that out because it says root of all in the universe. I'm guessing evil goes between all and in. Now, you can correct me if I've got it wrong, Marty. Who also has informed me that April 1st, 1976 was the birthday of Apple Computer. Well, happy birthday, Steve Jobs, but I'll let you buy your own cake. I mean, you know, it's not like... You know, lots of money there. Onward. At the same time that we have seen Walmart make legal war, and that's, you know, that's what a lawsuit is. It's a civilized war of words. It's an attempt on the part of the ruling class to keep the lower class from, you know, rising up and getting all, you know, uppity. Because rulers are always worried about their heads remaining attached to their necks. Witness Nouri al-Maliki trying to beat down, Muqtada al-Sadr before the possibility arises that the United States might actually do the right thing and get the hell out of Iraq, at which time Muqtada al-Sadr would come and give likely give Nouri al-Maliki the shave of a lifetime. But anyway, from The Independent in Great Britain. USA 2008, the Great Depression. Food stamps are the symbol of poverty in the U.S. Oh, I don't know. I might take issue with that. I think there's several symbols of poverty in the U.S. Cars on blocks in the front yard are a good start. Because you put them on the block so the wheels won't rust, and you took the tires off because you had to sell them to pay the power bill. That's a good indication. So how about food stamps are a symbol of poverty in the U.S.? In the era of the credit crunch, a record 28 million Americans are now relying on them to survive. A sure sign the world's richest country faces economic crisis. Well, pardon me. You do some great work there at The Independent, folks, but duh. David Usburn writes for The Independent, "We knew things were bad on Wall Street, but on Main Street it may be worse. Startling official statistics show that as a new economic recession stalks the United States, a record number of Americans will shortly be depending on food stamps just to feed themselves and their families." Let's put a qualifier on that. That with those food stamps, families will be expected to feed themselves on something on the order of $3 per person per day. 1 pound bag of beans, pinto beans, costs more than a buck. Pound of bacon? Little hunk of bacon? Way more than a buck. How about maybe some rice? You know, beans and rice are sort of the staple of poverty eating. Because they will keep you alive. And if you get real smart about things, they taste awful damn good. But you cannot, on $3 per person per day on food stamps in America, afford a bag of beans, a bag of rice, and a piece of otherwise not desirable meat with which to season it. You just can't. Out of this, sorry, no breakfast cereal. No milk. On the food stamp allotment for one human being per day in the United States, you cannot buy a gallon of milk. Let that sink in. We got trouble. We got trouble in River City. We got big trouble. And it's not going to let up anytime soon. And guess what? You're not going to get your answers from government. Because there are still enough Republicans in the Congress, in the House and the Senate, to squirrel anything that might be a meaningful reform. And there's still a certain jug-eared, pig-eyed little lout at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue who, even if we could squash the Republicans in Congress like a bug, would joyfully veto anything that came to him. So this is the, you know, this is the part of the trip that you just have to ride out till we come down. Some April Fool's joke, huh? from now, here, today, right now, April 1st, 2008, until January 20th, 2009, we just kind of have to sit and watch the walls breathe and the ferns grow legs and, you know, the colors and the shapes and the tracers and realize that, you know, this is not real, this is not real, this is not real, this will, but the thing is, it's real. Dismal projections by the Congressional Budget Office in Washington suggest that in the fiscal year starting in October, 28 million people in the U.S. will be using government food stamps to buy essential groceries, the highest level since the food assistance program, well, that's program with two M's and an E, by the way, real English, program was introduced in the 1960s. The increase from 26.5 million in 2007 is due partly to recent efforts to increase public awareness of the program and also a switch from paper coupons to electronic debit cards. But above all, it is the pressures being exerted on ordinary Americans by an economy that is suddenly beset by troubles, housing foreclosures, accelerating jobs losses, and fast rising prices all add to the squeeze. $2 a loaf bread right now, $4 by summer. Little tiny brick of frozen spinach in excess of a buck. We're in trouble. We're in bad trouble. And the people at the top end of our government, your government, my government, in other words, George W. Bush, that freak thinks that the band here on the Titanic is just darn fine. Man, they can really play. I've never heard a band play like that. They can really kick up a tune. They can play some. Yeah, I think that deck chair over there needs to be on the other side, away from the rail. Dick, get that deck chair over there. Yeah, I don't like how the deck chairs at all is sitting there. I think we need to rearrange them all. Especially with this tilt we got going on here. Everything's sliding to one side. Might ought to nail them down. Honest to God, that's where we are. Isn't it? The trend is not restricted to the Rust Belt regions. Talking about recessions and mini recessions. 40 states in the United States are reporting increases in applications for food stamps. At least 6 states, including Florida, Arizona, and Maryland, have had a 10% increase in the past year. Oh, it goes on and on. The article points out that we get the next monthly job numbers on Friday, and it will likely show a 50,000 job loss across the country this past month and a rising unemployment rate. The cost of feeding a low-income family of four has risen 6% in 12 months. Curiously, however, the food stamp allotment has not. Big darkness soon come. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita, how are you, dear?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Oh, that's kind of grim.
Yeah, I am too, in a way. I was going to call you yesterday, but I got listening to Laura, and that was so good. I was wanting to call about the impeachment situation.
Mm-hmm.
I read the thing where Obama, and I'm not picking on Obama because he's not the only one. Well, he wrote about that we didn't need to do that. We need to change things. And to me, that's what we need to change, is to do the impeachment and the investigations. It's, and I think Mark Levine was the one that said, that, what's the name of the representative? Conyers said that if we went to war with, Iran, that we would have impeachment.
Yeah, he did.
And I said, my God, I doubt it. We won't be able to have them, I guess. I don't think.
Well, I don't know how you pull it off. It would be.
But I mean, that's what we need to change.
Yeah, we're getting to a point where somebody has got to look at George Bush and say, look, you and Dick, you got to get out, man. We got real problems here. Go down to the Paraguay, do whatever you want to do, but we got to fix stuff. Unfortunately, they don't think that, and this is our problem. Boy, this is really our problem, Juanita. They don't think there's anything wrong.
You think the Democrats don't?
No. The Republican, the George Bush,
oh,
Dick
no.
Cheney.
Oh, no. Uh-uh.
And that's kind of hard to get through your head. And I don't mean yours. I mean all of us.
I know what you're saying now.
They really don't think there's anything wrong.
But that's really been bothering me. I read that it said, you know, we needed to do all these other changes, you know, instead of that. But that's what will change things for the better. Look at all the stuff he's, vetoed.
Mm-hmm.
And all the stuff he's demanding, and he's just so arrogant. And I know it's the same old thing we've talked about before, but still, you know, when you hear somebody that's in authority and they just don't seem to get it, and he's not the only one. I'm not picking
on. Well, why do you reckon they? I ask this. I'm not asking rhetorically. Why don't they get it, Juanita?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they don't want to.
I'm not arguing, but how can it possibly be that easy that they don't want to?
I don't know. I read a little something about said Nancy Pelosi's going to start being against any more funding for the war. Well, we've been heard stuff like that all this time, and then they turn around and they just give him everything they want that he wants. And I get grim about that kind of a thing. It's just so frustrating.
There was a movement back, and two or three politicians took place in it last year. Where, you know, they went out, and I think the governor of Oregon was one of them, and they lived on food stamps for a week.
Oh, yeah.
You know, remember? No cheating. Less than $3 a day. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
And it was called a political stunt. And the Republicans, of course, in classic fashion, came out and said, well, yeah, that's only because they're not being economical in their eating habits.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm reading articles now on dumpster diving. It's the new craze.
Yeah, I don't get it.
It's called freeganism or something like that. People go into the grocery store dumpster and see what kind of stuff got thrown out that night. The wealthiest country in the world cannot tolerate that kind of thing. But then again, of course it can, Juanita, because the people running the wealthiest country in the world don't give a rat's rear end if people live that way.
They surely don't. I think that's what they want. I'm beginning to think that's what they want. I ain't beginning to think it. I've been thinking it.
Desperate and people who are desperate and terrified are easily controlled.
Right. Absolutely. But hopefully they've backed us in the corner too far. Hopefully. You know what I'm saying? Then you get back in the corner enough, you're going to come out fighting, or you're going to die.
Well, you hope. But there's,
it is frustrating that the people who could do something, who have the ability to do something, I don't care what they say. They say they can't do this and they can't do that. They can, even if they don't succeed. They can try, try. Oh, gee.
But that's the thing. It's getting them to try. Food prices are going up. And, I mean, have you heard? I know you pay attention, Juanita. I pay attention. I haven't seen any bills going through Congress. I haven't seen any alerts from a congressman or anything like that saying that, you know, the progressive caucus or the Democrats in Congress are demanding a rise in food stamp allotments. I haven't seen any of that.
Uh-oh. Can I tell you a personal experience with food stamps?
If you want, sure.
Well, for a long time I was getting $10 a month food stamps.
Don't spend it all in one place.
Yeah, you get it, you know, with other benefits. And so anyway, you know, this last raise that we got, I lost it because I'm got too big of a raise.
Making too much money to be able to get any $10 worth of food stamps. I mean,
yeah.
Well, they're just trying to take care of you, Juanita. They don't want you getting all obese on that government dole.
Isn't that something? And were you the one that reported the other day? I tell you, I'm so scatterbrained about certain things. I just hear here and there. But you know the job sourcing that they've sent to India?
Yeah.
Did you hear that India had gotten so much of it that they had to outsource it? And one place they outsourced it.
That wasn't me, but that's not surprising in the least.
And then Germany outsourced it somewhere, and now they're starting to send some of it back over here. I would love to have those jobs. I know I could do better than some of them can. Some of them are okay, but some of them you can't understand them. And they get upset when you don't understand them.
Well, and so do you. I mean, but let me throw something your way, and I'm not trying to. This is not April Fool's joke, and I'm not trying to play any sort of right wing jokes or anything like that. But one of the things that's come up as a topic of conversation lately, Juanita, is the fact that the average American is semi literate.
Oh yeah.
Comprehends a whole bunch of stuff on a sixth grade level.
Yeah.
How are you supposed to run a high-tech call center with workers like that? I mean, that's the excuse that they put out there. If Mercedes or BMW or Nissan or Toyota wants to build a new plant, that's the new thing that they say. You know, well, I mean, you know, we'd love to build one in America, but your workers are too stupid.
Yeah, I heard that. And another thing I hate, and Bush does it all the time, is American workers just won't do these jobs, you know. And my son brought it up to me. He said, you know, your parents, that's an insult to them because they came down from Georgia during the Depression to get work down here, and they took what they would call migrant jobs now.
Sure.
And they were glad to get it.
And you know what?
There was nothing in Georgia.
No. And that's the thing. I hate that when Georgia, I mean, jobs that Americans won't do. No, they're jobs that Americans can't do for slave labor wages. They can't because.
You have to have transportation. You have to, and Central Florida's getting paved over by these interstate highways or whatever. And I was talking to got James about it the other day, and he said where he lives in South Florida, and he said they don't have enough roads down there. And up here, for some reason, they're building houses all over, you know, like one-family housing and condominiums.
Well, that's the thing, though.
Where are these people coming from?
Central Florida, away from the coast, has all the benefits of Florida, namely, you know, the warmth, the semi-tropical climate.
But
you're far enough inland that maybe you don't get completely hammered by the next hurricane. That's what, I mean, I'm guessing that's part of what's driving the development in Central Florida.
I'm suspicious that there's something else to it. Because it's strange. And then my girlfriend, I told you about my right-wing girlfriend, she lives out in the county and from this little town not too far from here. And about 30,000 people. And they just all of a sudden got a letter in the mail. They were going to have a meeting with the mayor of that city. And what it was about was they were wanting to put the city limits out toward their way because they wanted to build a bunch of houses out there. And they're all up. She's going around collecting names. And so she doesn't know what in the world. You know, they told them that that's why they lived out of the city limits, because they didn't want all that. If they wanted to live in town, they would have bought a house in town or something. And it's not a growing community.
Well, look, it's not going to take much to make Florida reach a point of economic collapse.
Of what?
Economic collapse.
Oh, yeah. And we have a lot of those.
But nobody wants to talk. Nobody wants to talk about that because
we have those attractions here too, you know, and they're going to lose out. You know, Disney World and all. I don't even go there. They charge the cotton picking much money for everything. It's parking. But it's like a domino effect. It's just all connected, and they don't. Either they don't care or they just don't think.
Well, but that's because of the mindset that's taken hold. America lives in this myth of growth, Juanita. You know, growth. We got to have growth. Oh, we had 3% growth next year. Oh, we'd like to have 5% growth next year. Oh, we want some growth. We need some growth. Growth is good. Growth is everything we got. Growth is meat and potatoes. Growth is Frisbees and Wheat Chex. Oh, we need growth.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they never, and this is just the way that I've come to look at it, all of these people hollering growth seem to have forgotten that any kind, that you know, if you look at it from a human standpoint, growth that gets out of control is commonly referred to as cancer.
As what?
Cancer. Inside your body, if something just starts growing and growing and growing and just getting it, cancer.
Yeah.
And you know what? Yeah. You can have ecological cancer. You can have environmental cancer. You can have sociological cancer. You can have cultural cancer. And you know what? The United States is plumb eat up with every last bit of it.
You are so right. There is just it's not, and it didn't just start 8 years ago. It just get started. It's been going on. It just started with the Gallup 8 years ago.
Ever
the guys came in.
Yeah.
They didn't waste any time.
Well, everything that I read says that the big fund's going to start in the next 10 years or so, and that the party will be in full swing by 50 years from now. And that there's not a lot, what we can do to change it, we're not doing, because we are nationally speaking, we are far too loaded. We are far too drunked up, drugged up, screwed up, messed up to sober up long enough to want to get clean. To use that ongoing analogy. So you know, it's not inspiring. Hey Juanita, I got to run along, dear. But thank you for all your thoughts.
Okay, you're welcome, and you are wonderful.
God, I knew you were going to do that.
Okay.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I know what she was up to, and I'm not going to. Oh, no, not going to. We'll take a quick break. Light up the phones if you want to. Let's talk this out. Let's see if we can come to some sort of consensus or conclusion about where we're going. A couple of emails on the way, a couple of phone calls coming. This won't take long. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn.
Go the beans, go the beans, go the beans, good time. down my can of beans, hand me down my can of beans, hand me down my can of beans, I'm throwing it away. Out the window go the beans, out the window go the beans, out the window go the beans, I had a lucky day. Mary, Mary, Mike, you can marry, we're going out this evening. Mary, Mary, I'm gonna take you out tonight. So hand me down that can of beans, hand me down that can of beans, hand me down that can of beans, I'm throwing it away. Out the window, throw the beans, out the window, throw the beans, out the window, throw the beans, throw the beans, throw the beans, the times are here to stay. Yeah. Hand me down that can of beans, hand me down that can of beans, hand me down that can of beans, I'm throwing it away.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Oh dear, he's playing show tunes now. Not a good sign, is it? Something's getting to me. 12 minutes after 7 o'clock here in the hills and hollers of beautiful, wild, wonderful West by God, Virginia. I'm Bob. And a generalized conversation on the State of the Union, if you will. A sort of a conversation that should probably take place every minute of every hour of every day somewhere in this country, and is the last conversation that our betters want us to have. You realize how subversive you are in participating in conversation radio? Do you realize how dangerous conversation radio is to the silk suit crowd, to the crowd that's into their Lark's Vomit canapé and their crispy fried hummingbird tongues? Nobody's making any threats. Nobody wants to see anybody hurt. Nobody's going to hurt anybody. But these kinds of conversations are patently dangerous to our betters, because it means that we're rubbing the sleep from our eyes and trying desperately to wake up. Few thoughts. All the rednecks around here complain about gas and food prices, yet right now they're all voting for McStrange and Luscious Lindsay. You can't buy nutrition bars with food stamps since they contain vitamins and minerals, because those are classified as vitamins. It occurs to me there are three stages of public reaction to a bad government. The stages are based on the personal circumstance of the general populace. A reasonably well-paid and secure populace with time to watch and look will push back and would be considered dangerous by a lousy administration looking to keep its position. What did I just say? An underpaid, under-benefited populace in a downward spiral is scared and unwilling to act so as to avoid further loss. No threat to a lousy government. A general populace that knows it has nothing else to lose knows no bounds in its desire to take back its birthright. We're kind of in the middle spot right now, don't you think? Sadly, yes. Underpaid, under-benefited, underappreciated populace in a downward spiral, terrified of doing anything. What's that old Latin aphorism translated, for fear of failing, he sat still? And then there's always, don't just stand there, do something. But in terror, movement, any movement, is the hardest task of all. Do something, even if it's wrong. Some sports coach, I think, said that somewhere along the way. Bear Bryant used to say, make something happen. And it's that whole make something happen thing that's the problem for us here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Because we're terrified that the something we make happen might be deemed by someone among our betters to be the wrong thing. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Susan.
Hey, Susan, what's up?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, do something even if it's wrong is something I remember back when I was five hearing from my mother. Do something. Even if it's wrong, do something.
Yeah.
I got that pounded into my head from
because the reason behind that is that in the grand scheme of things, most action is never completely, utterly, and totally wrong.
Yeah.
It has some sort of curative effect in some in some direction. So,
oh yeah, I realized that a long time ago. And you know, my mother was in a lot of ways a very wise woman. That was one of her favorite things. Another one was involved lemmings in a cliff. And you know where that one's going.
Sure, absolutely.
But, and I figure I got my sense of independence mostly from her, but also from my father. But the main reason I called is, you know, you mentioned call centers, high-tech call centers, and the quality of the workers they get.
Right.
I used to work in one, so I can tell you firsthand how they go about getting their workers and what type of people make it. What they do is they put out a generalized call to a temp agency. You're never hired by the actual call center. Ever.
Right. No, they wouldn't want to be having employees or anything.
Right. No. Because that way, if you don't work out for whatever reason, they just drop you. They don't need a cause. They don't need anything. They just said, go, leave. The majority of the people that came in with me qualified as... would qualify as dumb. Not because they were mentally stupid, but because they were kids.
Yeah, sure.
They had what you can get, the type of worker you can get for what you're willing to pay. You're going to get kids. You're going to get people coming back into the job force from long time periods out of it. And when you do, most of those people that come in are going to be dropped 9 times out of 10. For not bothering to show up, mainly because they're hungover, they've been partying, whatever, their kids, you know.
Oh, I worked in a call center here, Susan, and everything you're describing, mm-hmm. I can verify, because, you know, you want a great example. I worked in this call center, and I was just, you know, another guy working another phone, but I have some different skills. And I was a sort of a different breed of cat from what they were used to seeing, and therefore I did well.
Yeah.
But there was also a price that came with it. I think I told the story one night. I said, yeah, I'm going for a cigarette. No, the guy said, hey, get one more sale and you can go for a cigarette. I said, I think I'll go for that cigarette right now. Well, you can't do that. Fire me. I'm going for a cigarette. I want a cigarette. I'm going to go get a cigarette. And then I'll come back and sell some more for you. So if you want to tell your boss why you just canned the guy who's doing more sales than anybody else on this floor, do it. No skin off my nose. Otherwise, shut up till I get back from my cigarette. Nobody dared talk to these people that way. Well, I did. And I did look, and there were, you know, there, and that demographic that you just mentioned, kids without a lot of training, and folks who'd been out of the workforce and were coming back for some desperate reason or another, that was precisely the makeup of that calling floor.
Yeah.
And I quietly had some conversations here and there on those smoke breaks, lunch breaks, that kind of stuff. And I had said, you know, these could be much better jobs if we had a union. And you know what? Everybody I talked to said, damn right, Bob. How do we do it? I said, I'll make some contacts. I said, now you're not sitting here blowing smoke at me. I said, if I bring you a card, you'll sign a card, right? Yeah, boy. Even if they threaten to fire you? Mm-hmm. Susan, as God is my witness, I begged the Communications Workers of America. I implored them. I called them. I wrote them. Please, please organize this shop. You know what I got?
What?
No, thank you. No, we're not interested.
And that was their failure.
And the reason I was giving, well, you know, there's a lot of transient workers there. I mean, there's seasonal people, you know, like the, and because there's a lot of tourism here, the whitewater rafting industry. And, well, you know, a lot of those people only work for a little while because they've got jobs, you know, in the whitewater business. And, you know, they come and they go and they wouldn't be good for membership.
Oh, you idiot.
And I said, well, you know, what if these people had good enough jobs to make them want to stay instead? Well, you know, that's just not worth the risk for us. Risk for you? You've got people who are willing to sign on and fight your battle for you to organize a shop? And you're worried about your risk?
See, that's the difference between where you worked and where I worked, because we knew from day one. It was never spoken, but we knew from day one that the company would gleefully shut down the entire building and move it out rather than unionize it.
And that's what they ultimately did, isn't it?
No, it's still there. The contract was moved out of the country.
Right.
The company's still there.
Yeah.
But, you know, the problem is, you know, even with high-tech support, which is what I was doing, you know, this was just evident.
Well, this place brought people in at $6.45 an hour, moved them to $7.15 after 6 months, and if you would, at your own expense, go and get an insurance sales license from the state of West Virginia, why, they'd pay you almost $10 an hour.
Oh, God, I started at $10.24 an hour.
Yeah. Of course, the guy who owned the place was a fundamentalist.
But then you have to remember this is also Oregon, which has a much higher minimum wage. But the thing is, I worked there for close to 5 years, and I never got to $12. And my evaluations were stellar all the way through. I was one of their best people. I trained other people. They're not willing pay people what they're worth. And so, yeah, they're going to get new kids. They're going to get older people coming back in. And so, yeah, they're not going to get the quality. And as soon as somebody gets enough experience to go to another job, then they're out of there like a shot.
Well, you know, but that is the state of the American worker, Susan.
Yeah.
The people, I mean, I have no problem believing the AFL-CIO when they say that there's, what, 60, 80 million Americans who would love to be a member of a union if only they were allowed to do so.
Yeah.
Because I met the people, and they were some of those middle-aged returning to the workforce people, and some of them were youngsters just out of high school, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had positive responses across the board. to the idea of being a member of a union.
Yeah. And yet the union wouldn't do anything. And I find that absolutely reprehensible.
Yeah, I know. I know. The overarching thing is the terrified worker, the scared worker.
Yeah.
You know, if you live in a place where there aren't that many jobs and you have one, the last thing you want to do is rock the boat, because if you're out, man, you are so out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's basically what Oregon is now. The people who have jobs are hanging on to them like grim death, and us people who are out of jobs, we're not even bothering to look because we know there are none there.
Yes, you are what the Bush administration now terms a depressed worker.
Up yours, George.
Yeah, I know.
I just went blank. Oh, one more thought.
Sure.
All of the fun and games that George is getting up to in this last year, all of the things that he has managed to do in this last year of his. Harry, Nancy, if you'd gotten off your tush and put impeachment on the table, do you think maybe he would have been a little bit more cautious about it? Maybe.
Well, he certainly would have been too busy fending off an impeachment to start, you know, saber rattling against Iran. But, you know, so what?
Yeah, exactly. And so I blame.
Oh, by the way, did you notice who had to fix the little flare-up civil war that was going down in Iraq? Did you notice who fixed that, Susan?
Yeah, Muqtada al-Sadr.
No. Who fixed that was Iran. The United States couldn't fix it. We couldn't make it stop. Iran came in and brokered a deal, but they're evil.
Yeah, they're evil, but they brought in and stopped the war. Yeah, tell me about evil, guys.
But we can't sit down and talk with them because they're evil.
I could say something rude, crude, and unladylike, but I won't.
I know. About 90% of this show is me fighting off the urge to just power swear for, you know, the other 10%.
Oh, I like that term, power swear. That's cool.
No, you can use it freely. The royalties are quite low.
Oh, okay. I'll do that.
Okay, Susan, take care.
Love to hang.
All right, bye now.
Bye-bye.
Let's see. Another email just rolled in. Let's check on that. Oh yeah. By the way, yeah, I played that. So that was to hand me down the can of beans from at the top of the hour from the musical Paint Your Wagon. Oh delight! I can just see the June Taylor dancers now. Or is that Marge and Gower champion? Oh, everybody! Yeah, everybody's 10,000 starving comedians in the world, and I got a funny audience. No, I really do. It's wonderful. But speaking of dancers, this is at least good for a giggle. You remember the video of George doing the old soft shoe from a couple of weeks ago, right? Well, having viewed that video, Maureen Dowd, of whom Bart Kopp always says she hates everybody, she's sort of the Mikey of opinion journalism. She hates everybody. She made a reference to Bush's soft shoeing as acting like Gene Kelly. Now, for those of you who love old movies, there's none better. Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, you know, we will not see their like again. And as for me, yeah, I prefer Gene Kelly. Although Fred Astaire runs a mighty tight second. And for some, I'm sure it is first among them. Well, it turns out that when Maureen Dowd, who hates everybody, accused George Bush of acting like Gene Kelly, somebody fired off a letter to the New York Times. That somebody was a person by the name of Patricia Ward Kelly. Patricia Ward Kelly wrote to the New York Times, "Surely it must have been a slip for Maureen Dowd to align the artistry of my late husband, Gene Kelly, with the president's clumsy performances, to suggest that, quote, George Bush has turned into Gene Kelly, unquote, represents not only an implausible transformation, but a considerable slight. If Gene were in a grave, he would have turned over in it." When Gene was compared to the grace and agility of Jack Dempsey, Wayne Gretzky, and Willie Mays, he was delighted. But to be linked with a clunker, particularly one he would consider inept and demoralizing, would have sent him reeling. Graduated with a degree in economics from Pitt, Gene was not only a gifted dancer, director, and choreographer, he was also a most civilized man. He spoke multiple languages, wrote poetry, studied history, understood the projections of Adam Smith and John Maynard Keynes. He did the Sunday Times crossword in ink. Exceedingly articulate, Gene often conveyed more through movement than others manage with words. Sadly, President Bush fails to communicate meaningfully with either. For George Bush to become Gene Kelly would require impossible leaps in creativity, erudition, and humility. Signed, Patricia Ward Kelly, Los Angeles, March 16th. That's just beautiful. That's probably the best usage of ink that the New York Times is engaged in nigh unto forever. So we'll take a little break, and we'll come back. Your phone calls, hopefully, your emails, what passes for thoughts in the thin gray settlings between my ears, all of that is on the way, right here on America's Liberal Voice, America's listener-supported liberal voice, The Horn. We'll be back. Wow. Wow, 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 wow. John just sent that along. That is just that's just stunning. A group by the name of Iron Horse, ironhorsebluegrass.com, I think, is the ironhorsebluegrass.com. And a stunning cover of a metal staple. God, that's why I love music. You know, the tough part sometimes of this little undertaking that we engage in here is the segue, so to speak. Trying to go seamlessly from one story to the next and having it make some sort of sense. And I'm in one of those right now because everything that I'm clicking through that I've got on all of my tabs, and God knows I've got about 8 million tabs open right now, seems to take me somewhere I don't want to go. And I suspect you don't want to either. But we're going just the same. We're on the ride and clacking up the hill, and you know that sort of stomach-lifting sensation of that lurching sort of... Because it's all, either I'm in a creepy place, or the world is. Or maybe we all are. I got a couple of funnies to hang on to for later. But for right now, a blogger by the name of Noah Schachtman, I had a blog by the name of Danger Room, and this is the beauty of the blogosphere. This is stuff that mainstream journalism couldn't come up with on a dare, because even the most dedicated so-called professional journalists are steered away from this kind of stuff, lest it pull too much of the curtain back. We get a peep once in a while, but never the full-on view. Noah Schachtman found a 2006 report that was prepared for U.S. Special Operations Command. USOC. No, really, I didn't make that up. USOC. U.S. Special Operations Command. That suggests ways... this is all there over there at thinkprogress.org. You can go find it, too. That the military should deal with the blogosphere. Because, you see, bloggers are now deemed a threat to national security. Why do you think we had that language in that amorphous bill that came rolling out of the Congress with only two nay votes on it that talked about homegrown terrorism and other things? Jesus. Legislation that's any legislation. You know, legislation to protect children from grizzly bears and other things. The other things should... Anytime you see something like "and other stuff" in a piece of legislation, duck. But no, a memo on how the military should deal with the blogosphere. Wait till you see... And you know, they think the same way. That's why we wind up losing wars in Iraq. There's not any real... Oh, I hate to say out-of-the-box thinking, because that's so cliched. Not any new thinking. There's no attempt to think any way except the old. Well, we used to think this way, and thinking that way got us here, so let's keep thinking that way. I mean, that's the thinking that got you things like, what was it, the wheat field or the corn field, some field at Antietam, where people with rifled muskets were lined up at ranges for unrifled Napoleonic warfare tactics, and just it was hell. It was horror. It was butchery. But, you know, same old thinking. Well, we got to line up across from each other and just shoot the hell out of each other. Well, what are you going to do? Well, this is a case of that. One suggestion for dealing with the blogosphere, of course, is to subvert the blogosphere. Hire bloggers to, quote, pass the U.S. message, This is information strategists can consider clandestinely recruiting or hiring prominent bloggers or other persons of prominence to pass the U.S. message. On the other hand, such operations can have a blowback effect, as witnessed by the public reaction following revelations that the U.S. military had paid journalists to publish stories in the Iraqi press under their own names. People do not like to be deceived. Wait a minute! New thinking at the Pentagon! Ding, 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 ding! People do not like to be deceived, and the price of being exposed is lost credibility and trust. Pentagon's just another word for nothing left to lose. An alternative strategy is to make a blog and blogger. The process of boosting the blog to a position of influence could take some time. However, and depending on the person running the blog, may impose a significant educational burden. Oh, Lord. Who were they thinking of? Michelle Malkin. Oh, my God. Politico. In terms of cultural and linguistic training before the blog could be put online to any useful effect. Still, there are people in the military today who like to blog. Oh, it's Deep Sigh Tuesday on the Head-On Radio Network. Obviously, they haven't... Look around the right wing. Where do you think they've poured some money? We got $9 billion missing in Iraq. Wonder where it went. Do you ever go and read any of these right-wing blogs? If you do, it's not hard to imagine some Pentagon money going here and there. Okay, we're going to give you some money to fund your blog, and here's a little bit extra so you can take a grammar and syntax course so you can actually do all your toe typing in decent English. That makes way too much sense. You know, rather than trying to do, you know, rather than the Pentagon actually trying to do the right thing, the Pentagon thinks it would be simpler instead to continue doing the wrong thing and pay some people to tell the world that it's the right thing to do. Just makes the little marbles inside my skull rattle around. Your tax dollars at work. Sure enough. So next time you see a post from a right-wing from the right-wing blogosphere, ask yourself, how much did the Pentagon pay? Then again, the first paragraph is telling too, recruiting or hiring prominent bloggers to pass the U.S. message along. You think they'd ever do that? No. Not the Pentagon. Not the folks that brought you things like total information awareness. Heck no. No. They're butter wouldn't melt in the Pentagon's mouth. Why, the brass wouldn't say poopy if they had a mouthful. They're honest, the Pentagon. Sure they are. Not. But it's there before you. Do with it what you wish. Would the Pentagon brass be so dishonest, so disingenuous, so utterly, hopelessly, ineptly corrupt as to try to buy their message onto the blogosphere? Secondly, are there right-wing bloggers who themselves are so corrupt that they would take the Pentagon's money to parrot the Pentagon's line? What do you think? Come on. I say yes and yes. And it explains a lot. It explains a whole lot of the rah-rah on the right wing. And the ones that are still out there say, the surge is working. Hey, look, we just had the single deadliest month for American soldiers since August of 2007. Surge is working! See, we got a lot more soldiers killed. That proves the surge is working. Aren't we smart? Also, with regard to issues militaire, California Congresswoman Jane Harman shared information in the Los Angeles Times recently. About a subject that is sickening. The ungodly number of sexual assaults within the military. In the LA Times, Congresswoman Harman wrote, "Women serving in the U.S. military, they dig this statistic." I know, there's lies and statistics. But this one just got all over me when I read it earlier. Women serving in the U.S. military are more likely to be raped by a fellow soldier than killed by enemy fire in Iraq. She goes on and writes, "At the heart of this crisis is an apparent inability or unwillingness to prosecute rapists in the ranks." Congresswoman Harman, I'm not disagreeing with you. I don't disagree with you, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, dear. But what do you want from a military that gives a walk to a guy who went into a room filled with Iraqi women and children and old men and slaughters each and every one of them? That's what happened in Haditha, you know. The guy who just took a walk on it, who had his charges dismissed, with no evidence whatsoever of a plea agreement in exchange for his testimony. He committed the cold-blooded murder of something in excess of 15 non-combatants. 15 women, children, old men. And the U.S. military's just looked at him and said, "Done good, boy! Might be a promotion in it for you." Okay, maybe not the promotion part. But if dismissing all charges against an accused murderer isn't a tacit approval of his actions, what in the hell is it? Now, Congresswoman Harman says, "At the heart of this crisis is an apparent inability or an unwillingness to prosecute rapists in the ranks. According to Department of Defense statistics, only 181 out of 2,212 subjects investigated for sexual assault in 2007, including 1,259 reports of rape, were referred to courts-martial, the equivalent of a criminal prosecution in the military. Another 218 were handled via non-punitive administrative action or discharge. And 201 subjects were disciplined through non-judicial punishment, which means they may have been confined to quarters, assigned extra duty, or received a similar slap on the wrist. In nearly half of the cases investigated, the chain of command took no action. More than a third of the time, that was because of insufficient evidence. The absence of rigorous prosecution perpetuates a culture tolerant of sexual assault, an attitude that says, boys will be boys, No, Congresswoman Harmon. It's more like boys will be rapists. That's war, madam. Things like this happen in war. Meanwhile, you think back to the poor thing that went to work for Kellogg Burn and Loot. Wasn't it KBR? I think so. Who was raped and then kept in a shipping container for a few days until she'd realized that maybe she might want to keep her mouth shut about it and just be some contractor's little sex toy until she was sent home or killed. Anybody want to sing? What in this is there to be proud of? But see, this is where something like having a paid-off blogger comes in handy. To an active member of the armed forces, being confined to quarters is no slap on the wrist. It is an assault upon his honor. Yeah, see, that's how you'd blog something like that. How many right-wingers are there out there that have gleefully cheered the dropping of charges against the Haditha slaughterer? Care to look? Care to find out? You won't like what you find out. It's disturbing. Disturbing in the extreme. Yes, it is indeed. But so is everything associated with this occupation. It was horrifying in its origins, and it is horrifying in its perpetuation. And it stands to shatter our military into 1,000 pieces that cannot be put back together again. That we will be another 25 years shaking off just as we were with Vietnam. Lord. Is there an answer to something like this? Of course there's an answer to something like this. Now, you know the right-wing answer.
Well, we tried to tell them all along women didn't have no business in combat. Combat's a hard business.
Sergeant, we're talking about rape here.
Well, you know, when you come out from a hard day on patrol, you get back to the base, anything looks good. I mean, you can't expect a soldier who's been out risking his life to come back and just remember that he can't jump on anything that's got a...
That's how they are, the right wing. Everything associated with the American military is excusable.
Well, see, he just had one of his buddies die in an IED. That's why he went in there and gunned down them 15, 18 people that wasn't doing nothing to him. That's why he done it. He was blind with bloodlust for revenge. And you got to understand and accept that, because it's war, and war's hell.
I mean, I can sit here and do that kind of stuff because I've had it said directly to me.
Well, you can't understand because you ain't there. But, you know, you're going... You kill a civilian, you get tried. You rape a civilian, you get tried. Well, what's he supposed to do then? He's going to come back and rape one of the women in the military. That's just how it is.
I guess the question is that how it has to be? Not is it how it is, but is it how it has to be? And it's... It's a question that's largely going unanswered, according to according to Congresswoman Jane Harman. More's the pity. We'll come back in a little bit. A little interlude. And, yeah, there's other stuff. Don't know that it's any more promising than this. This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
I tried desperately to find some... Well, okay, I got a couple of funnies for you. I mean, well, sort of funny, in a life in America kind of way. We'll get at those, so and you know, put them in there as kickers toward the end of the program, so maybe you won't go away from the show just wanting to run a warm bath and jump in with a fresh set of treats. Okay. But before we do that, CBS reporting on 60 Minutes Sunday night. The story of then 19-year-old Murat Kumaz who truly lived the Kafka-esque life, if you will. He was from Germany. Murat Kumaz was. He was traveling in Pakistan. You know, some people do go to Pakistan without wanting to bomb anything. I know it's hard to believe, but it's true. And he got picked up there 3 months after September 11th, 2001. The FBI, at the time he was picked up, was pretty sure Kumaz was innocent. U.S. intelligence was pretty sure Kumaz was innocent. German intelligence said Kumaz was innocent. But that didn't matter. Because he had fallen into the George W. Bush Dick Cheney Memorial Hellhole. And no evidence of innocence, no evidence of lack of guilt, nothing stood in the way between him and torture. He says that, well, in the 60 Minutes episode, he said, they stopped the bus, and because of my color, I'm much more different than Pakistani guys. He looked into the bus, and he knocked on my window. He was a Pakistani cop, pulled Kumaz off the bus. He said, I was sure soon as they would find out I'm not a terrorist, they will apologize for it and let me go back home. No, sorry. But they put him on a plane, flew him out of Pakistan to a U.S. base in Kandahar, Afghanistan. You know, that burgeoning democracy. And they put him in the run of the prison with folks who had just come off the battlefield, who were picked up as war criminals because they had the unmitigated temerity, not prisoners of war, war criminals, because they had the unmitigated temerity to fight back against people who were shooting at them. I have yet to see anybody who can stop a bullet with a rousing chorus of Kumbaya. Generally, when someone's shooting at you, the only thing you can do to get them to stop shooting at you is to shoot them first. But George W. Bush doesn't understand that. He was kept in an outdoor pen in sub-freezing weather. He was interrogated daily. Every day they asked him, where is Osama bin Laden? Are you from Al-Qaeda or from the Taliban? He said, I don't know where is Osama bin Laden. I never saw him, and I don't know anything about Al-Qaeda. I don't know what it is. I told them they can just call Germany to ask who I am, and they can ask anybody in Germany who I am. Hans at the bar knows who I am. What a nightmare. The lawyer for this poor soul says there was no reason to suspect that Kumaz knew anything about Al-Qaeda. But, you know, it was weeks after September 11th, and anything goes, right?
We're going to get somebody. We're going to get some revenge for this. It don't matter if they had anything to do with it. We're going to kill somebody. Might have to use a sling blade.
The lawyer says the police report was sent to the Americans. Kumaz claims his interrogations at Kandahar then turned to torture. They used to beat me. He's talking about American soldiers here. We're talking about an unarmed man here. We're talking about a prisoner here. They used to beat me when my head is underwater. They beat me into my stomach and everything. Scott Pelley of CBS asked him when he told them that they beat him while his head was underwater. He said, they were hitting you in the stomach while your head was underwater so that you had to take a breath? Right. I had to drink. I had to, how you say it, inhale. Inhale the water. I had to inhale the water. Right. He also says the Americans used a device to shock him with electricity that made his body go numb. And then he was hoisted up on chains, suspended by his arms from the ceiling of an aircraft hangar for 5 days. Sounds sort of like John McCain's revenge, doesn't it? Every 5 or 6 hours they came and pulled me back down, and the doctor came to watch if I can still survive or not. He looked into my eyes. He checked my heart. And when he said, okay, then they pulled me back up. Scott Pelley asked him, I suspect you know that the U.S. military will deny this happened. The U.S. military will deny that you were shocked. It will deny your head was held in a bucket of water. It will deny that you hung from a ceiling for days at a time. Kumaz says, doesn't matter whatever they will say. The truth will not change. This is the truth. So this all happened in Kandahar. It happened for 6 weeks. But then his life got better. No, sorry. He just found a new door, a new window, into a little warmer section of hell, because he was stuffed into an aircraft and flown off to that fortress of democracy at Guantanamo. There, he was interrogated for months on end. He was beaten. He was subjected to sleep deprivation, solitary confinement, without ventilation, total darkness, totally sealed, year after year. Then in 2004, according to the article, the U.S. Supreme Court noted that Guantanamo prisoners did have the right to lawyers, and to his complete surprise, one day Kumaz was told that he had a visitor. It was an American lawyer. Azmi gave his account of how he first met Mr. Kumaz. Quote, he was chained to a bolt in the floor around his ankle, and had an absolutely enormous beard that had marked the years that he was in detention. He looked like someone who had been shipwrecked, which, of course, in a sense, he really was. He goes on and says, this goes to the utter preposterousness of the government's legal process that they established in Guantanamo. This tribunal system that was supposed to differentiate from enemy combatant and civilian, so in order to justify that he was an enemy combatant, they simply made up an allegation about someone he was associated with. 6 months after Kumaz reached Guantanamo, U.S. military intelligence had written, quote, criminal investigation task force has no definite link, evidence of detainee having any association with Al-Qaeda or making any specific threat toward the U.S. the German government and German intelligence wrote the German government saying USA considers Murat Kumaz's innocence to be proven. He is to be released in approximately 6 to 8 weeks. But after that memo was written in 2002, he was kept and tormented at Guantanamo for 3.5 years, making up charges as they went along. He was 19 when he went in to this U.S.-manufactured hell, 24 when he got back to Bremen in Germany. By that time, his wife had divorced him. He says he'd like to visit the United States, but he can't because the U.S. still considers him to be an unlawful enemy combatant. A man who never even shouldered a weapon. A man who was not part of any fighting force. No one will be tried for this. No one will be imprisoned for this. No one will be demoted in rank for this. No one will be challenged for this. Not a question will be asked of the Secretary of Defense or then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice or of Stephen Hadley or of Donald Rumsfeld or of Dick Cheney or of George Bush. Because, of course, impeachment is off the table. And what's the use of impeachment anyway? George would just say, I didn't know anything about it. How do we know he's not an enemy combatant? Did he ever prove he's not an enemy combatant? My first job as commander-in-chief is to protect the American people. No, dumbass. Your first job as commander-in-chief. Well, commander-in-chief isn't your first job. Your first job is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. And what of the doctor? Can you imagine going through 4 years of undergraduate school, 4 years of medical school, 1 year of internship, a couple of years of residency, and finding yourself at a prison in Kandahar, Afghanistan, where, having a few years before ceremonially taken the Hippocratic Oath, whose opening lines are, first, do no harm, taking that medical training and defecating all over everything embodied in the Hippocratic Oath and everything in what is considered to be medical ethics, and reducing your practice to nothing more than seeing a 19-year-old light-skinned man of Pakistani origin lowered from chains long enough for you to make sure his heart was still beating, that his pupils were not completely dilated, that he had a pulse and something approaching regular breathing patterns, and then, as a doctor, as someone who is sworn to minister to the sick, looking at the barbaric soldiers around you and saying, hoist him back up, boys. He can take some more. Call me if he pukes. See, that's the problem with these stories. They're horrifying, and what they do to our sense of right and wrong in this country, and more importantly, what they do to the world's view of this country, is beyond criminal. but they still don't do enough. Because that doctor's name was not given, and no attempt has been made to find out who that doctor is, and the Pentagon will not ever try to find out who those war criminals were who did that to that innocent man. Not worth the effort.
Oh, we got a war on terror going on here. You know, if you want to make an omelet, sometimes you got to break a few skulls. Or eggs, I'm sorry.
Here in 4 or 5 years, somewhere in America, someone is going to take their child or their husband or their wife to the doctor, never knowing that the doctor they are visiting once spent his days giving approval to torture. And they will put the lives of their loved ones in the hands of that physician, never knowing that those hands have been bathed in innocent blood. And what will become of those patients, God Himself only knows. Because even the state medical licensing board won't know that they have licensed a war criminal, a Mengele. And yes, some politician out there might very nearly well befoul himself at the notion of having to stand up and say that a doctor like that is a Mengele, but by God, one thing you will get here, if you get nothing else, is the unvarnished and unfly-blown truth. And that doctor is a Mengele and should spend the rest of his natural-born life in a prison somewhere. But in a morally bankrupt, ethically decayed country like ours, that man will live out his life in pleasant, relatively quiet, fairly well-off circumstances, and no one will ever know who that mystery doctor was. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's up?
It's Pat.
Yeah, what's going on?
Well, I just I got home. Wife and kids are down the in-laws, and I...
Well, good to hear from you.
Yeah, I was listening to last night's podcast on my drive home. And
Oh, last night was a lot more fun than tonight.
I gather from the little bit I just caught. But I,
but it's hard to do a story like that and, you know, break into song. I you know, it just is.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking, you know, you were talking last night about the wonderful resource Martin Luther King's wiretaps are. And,
yeah, that phrase just drove me a little crazy.
I was thinking, you know, the East German Stasi must have some real wonderful resources. Ask the German people how they felt about that.
Oh, how true.
You know.
And, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe if there is any evidence of what happened to Mr. Kumaz, you know, oh, it's a wonderful resource.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. That was the main thing I wanted to call and say. I just caught the last bit that you were talking about.
Well, I appreciate it. Things are going well with you, I trust?
Yeah, yeah. The commute's a bear right now. And until I actually get hired on, you know, not doing the temp thing, we can't really think about moving.
Right.
You know, it's about an hour each way, so without bad traffic. which, you know, it's good that it gives me time to listen to the podcast and not have to, you know, listen with one other ear for a child or something.
Hey, listen, I broadcast with one other ear, so I completely understand that. Although, you know, Agnes is in the main house, you know, keeping everything nailed down nice and tight, but still, every now and then, you'll hear a noise and you go, huh, what? And, no, I understand that, yeah, it can be a little bit diverting, can't it?
Yeah. And speaking of Agnes, it was really great to hear, you know, for the brief moment we had on Friday. That was...
Well, I love having her back here. And, you know, we're doing some thinking here, and I think she, you know, once school's out, we're thinking seriously about, she is thinking seriously about coming back and getting back into the saddle for a little while, at least during the summer break. Because she, you know, she misses this too. But it, you know.
I believe it, you know. I mean, we are a family, and I don't care what anybody else says. You know, you guys are so important to me and to all the listeners, not only the ones that call and get on in the chat room.
Well, you know, I hope folks do feel about us the same way we feel about them, and that is that, you know, that there is a sense of community here and that we are bonded together in a way that we might never have imagined. And, you know, that's like having the new message boards, the forum open there at the network. It makes it a little more, makes the website a little bit more accessible for folks like you who don't listen live.
Right.
Who listen to a podcast. I think that's going to be a great resource.
I've been trying to catch the horn section live, but it's difficult when you have to get up at 5:45.
Oh.
to stay up till midnight.
I can't even think of what 5:45 looks like, Patrick. the only 5:45 that I'm cognizant of is the one that happens after noon.
Yep.
Of course, you know, but
without our brackets there, Bob.
Oh, we got so slaughtered.
I was hoping for a little more participation too, but
you know, I only mentioned it once, and I guess and there's a lot of there's a lot of people who just really, really aren't into it.
Yeah.
I mean, I get little notes explaining to me how wrong-headed I am for paying attention to sport, and how, you know, it's a tool designed to divert the attention of the masses and yada 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 yada, and there's some truth to it, but still, I can't do 24/7 of stories of tortured German dudes. I just can't do, because I'll just, you know, and it'll all be over. You know, clown suit, bell tower, rifle, done.
Yeah, well, I mean, you need to have some sort of distraction.
Although, you know, I think there's all kinds of stuff we can do out there. You know, the penny ante poker, I think, would be a lot of fun. The chat rooms are going to be fun. This one thing that a lot of us, John Fox got us involved in it, this little virtual, the United Nations got after them, but this sort of little virtual United Nations called nationstates.net.
Yeah, actually, I'm signed up on there now.
Are you really?
Yeah, I'm a Central Surrealist.
Oh, that's you? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, because I'd seen your country, and we're having a blast with it. My poor little economy's going down the toilet because I wouldn't mine for uranium, I guess. But we're all having a whole lot of fun with it.
Yeah, I'm a little bit, other than just taking care of the issues that come up, I don't. Is there other things, or are they just boards?
Yeah, mainly it's just boards and people talking about whatever, you know, whatever grabs them. I pop in a couple of times. I pop in once a day and check on the issues. And I think one of the fun things about it is learning which ones to ignore. You know, dismiss this issue.
Yeah.
As opposed to taking one position or the other.
Yeah.
My people have lots of civil rights but very few political rights. I haven't figured out why that is. But, you know, I had a lot of fun with it, setting up the nation of Cain Jeeves, and our flag is W.C. Fields' face, and our national motto is don't be a moon calf. Our state animal is the six-toed boondoggle. All of these things come out of W.C. Fields movies.
Right.
So, you know, I figured that would It's a good 10 minutes of my day every day that I don't mind giving up because it's just sort of fun to watch what happens. My population has grown from 5 million to 20 in the space of a week, and my economy is just in the toilet. And what else? I'm an eminence gris in my in terms of my influence in the region.
Yeah, so that's where I'm at, too. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but...
Isn't that like a professor emeritus or something? Or past master, or... I don't know. But, I don't think I'm going to be much of anything, because I don't get any issues that allow me to sort of juice my economy without doing something really awful.
Yeah, I don't understand what... My economy's been doing well, but I haven't had any economic issues come up yet. Except for like the freedom of speech stuff with the television show.
Yeah, I had that, and I don't know. Maybe just the longer you're in it, I think at some point that I'll do something radical and just take over dictatorial powers and see what it does to my Scandinavian liberal paradise. But you never know, Patrick. It's awfully good to hear from you. If you get a chance, think of me when you enjoy a good cigar. And
I'm doing it right now.
We will do. We'll do some cigar chat one night and drive the audience absolutely mad.
Absolutely. Take it easy, Bob.
All right. We'll see you, Patrick.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Patrick in Massachusetts calling in. He fancies a good cigar or a cigar once in a while. As do I. Let's see. Email rolls in from Andrew, whom we heard from for the first time in a while last night. He says, I just heard your reference to the Pentagon's plan to use paid prominent bloggers to parrot their message to America. To me, this is not scary or disturbing. It just affirms what the Pentagon and the Bush administration in general has been doing all along, which is pure, unadulterated propagandizing of the American people. What the Pentagon does not understand is this. The bloggers, who are not neocon, right-wing, knuckle-dragging ditto heads, we'll see through this garbage. We liberal bloggers have been dealing with the propaganda throughout the Bush administration's residency, and those prominent propaganda bloggers will be verbally and factually torn to shreds. Goebbels must be smiling in his grave to see his techniques enter the digital age by his ideological offspring. Let's just call the Pentagon's newly formed propaganda unit Operation Goebbels 2.0. I'm ready. Have a good night, Bob. You have a good night, Andrew. Andrew, our buddy 2 miles south of FDR's house. At least that kind of keeps things in perspective. Regarding rape in the ranks, makes it all so much more acceptable that when one Tracy Ullman became an American citizen recently, she was handed one thing and she heard one other. There was the little American flag made in China. She was encouraged to wave it while the sound system played Proud to be an American by Lee Greenwood for all the new citizens. There's a warm, fuzzy one for you. Lee Greenwood. Talk about asking your brand new citizens to sacrifice early. I won't do it to you. I won't. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey, this is Alan.
Hey, Alan, what's up?
I just wanted to tell you, you were saying something about doctors working in the prison, might be working over here on our patients.
Mm-hmm.
And you ever think about the military police working in prisons might be given tickets in the future here?
Oh, I have no doubt of it. At one point in time, the Beckley police, and I think they're in the Raleigh County Sheriff's Office, one county away from me, was severely depleted in manpower because most of them were in the Guard and had been called up and sent to Iraq. So, guys with PTSD and guns on the street in America. That's comforting. Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah, the guys who used to torture people will be out there with radars to give us tickets.
And guns. Don't forget the and guns part, and pepper spray, and nightsticks, and big old flashlights with 5D cell batteries in it.
And taser guns.
Whew. And what I something I mentioned last night, Alan. What happens when the Blackwater guys want to come home and make $100,000 a year doing in Iraq what they were doing here? That's the that really is the that's the $64 question. It's bad enough that we will have shattered members of the military coming back to a failed VA system that can't address their needs. But the Blackwater dudes don't even fall under that. They just come back and look at everybody funny until something clicks and they start shooting.
Mm.
Yeah, it's not a, it's not a trip to the ice cream stand that we've got coming when this all ends. And I, you know, that's not a reason for not ending it. But we have to end it in such a way that we can protect the American people from the people who are coming home. And I'm not trying to be mean to the military. You know, for the most part, most of the military is not the guy who massacred those people in Haditha. They want to come home, and they want to have their normal lives back, and their lives have been changed forever, and we, as the people at home, are not prepared to deal with the issues that they will bring home with them as their baggage from that hell.
Yeah, it seems like this can be worse than Vietnam because the violence is pretty much seems like it's sanctioned by the government. I mean, openly sanctioned.
Yeah.
I remember during, I think during the 80s, hearing about people who were in Vietnam going crazy. Even that. That's far after the war.
Well, you know, veterans are used as the excuse for homelessness in this country, Alan. If you try to talk to a Republican, I mean, we saw this with the flap with Bill O'Reilly a couple of months back. If you try to explain to Bill O'Reilly that America has a homeless problem, the first thing that a so-called conservative or a right-winger or a Republican or whatever they're calling themselves today, first thing they say, well, you know, that's because they're crazy. They want to be on the streets. They don't want to live in a house. They're so crazy. They want to live under bridges and drink screw top wine. Well, but Bill, you know, you say, and they did it. But they're veterans. Well, they're not really veterans. Because see, a Republican, Alan, takes a view of something like a war as a reflection on their personal character, as opposed to the national nightmare that any war is. And because they take it that way, they can't deal with the idea of a war being something other than an excuse to wave a flag and talk about how great we as the USA are, even if what we're doing isn't great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like my country's right around me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My country, 'tis of thee, land of a failing economy. Sorry, but
yeah,
you. But it is all going to come home to roost, and it. Whenever we do, man, and I think that might be part of what's behind the Bush administration, Alan. They don't know what to do with the troops if they bring them home, so they figure they'll just let them stay forever. And it wouldn't be the first time that a government had made that kind of. That kind of a decision. Rome let a bunch of legions just rot in the Middle East, right in the same place, because they were scared to death of what would happen when they came home.
That's pretty good, because no history like that. Unfortunately, history repeats itself too often.
And it's
you said that was Rome, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think they ultimately got slaughtered under the leadership of Marcus Licinius Crassus. You remember Pompey, Crassus, and Caesar, the triumvirate? Well, I think it was Crassus who got that legion done in. So they didn't have to worry about bringing them home.
And they were always going into other people's lands all the time and robbing and stealing.
Well, that's what that was all about, was trying to expand the borders of empire and find a few more peoples to shake down. And it seems like they ran into, I can't remember who it was they ran into, but they had mounted archers that just chewed them to pieces.
I went to where there was an American Revolutionary War battle. It's called King Mountain.
Oh, yeah, King's Mountain.
Yeah, I don't know if that's South Carolina or North Carolina. It's right on the line.
Well, it's where the hillbillies saved the idea of their being a United States of America. It's a fascinating story. A bunch of literally liquored up hillbillies forced marched over the mountain and stomped the guts out of the loyalist and their British leader, killed him on the battlefield, and kept the revolution going when it could have been brought to a screeching halt. And it really was. It was hill people. It was mountain people. It wasn't even people from there.
Yeah. I walked around the mountain and read these signs saying that the people didn't like to be occupied. And then another sign said that there was that the British had people working for them who were from this country. And then during the heat of the battle, they turned against the British. It seems like the same kind of things happened in Iraq.
Well, you know, one of my favorite books is Jeff Bigger's United States of Appalachia, and there's a wonderful account of the Battle of Kings Mountain in that book if you want to get your hands on it, Alan.
Oh, it sounds like a fascinating story.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is.
So I wouldn't want to be in it, but it sounded like it was a turning point in the war, wasn't it?
Oh, it literally saved the revolution.
And it's just regular guys who didn't want to be occupied by the British.
Yeah, and regular guys who weren't even necessarily, you know, from there. That's the part that blew me away.
Yeah, they're from, like, Tennessee and
yeah,
Virginia and different states all around.
Right.
Hey, did you know that Don Sigelman is out of prison?
Yes, I did. I think that's wonderful, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say when he testifies in Congress.
Uh-huh. I think he's already starting to talk about George Bush's right-hand man.
Yeah, Karl Rove. Yeah, he is already talking about it. He says it's got his handprints all over it.
Yeah. Well, I guess I better let you go, but I appreciate it. I didn't love listening to you.
It's always a pleasure to hear from you, Alan.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye now.
Bye.
Battle of Kings Mountain is a fascinating story, and like I said, the account that Jeff Biggers gives of it in the United States of Appalachia is utterly compelling. Had a conversation with Jeff off the air the other day, and he's got another project in the works that I think is going to be absolutely fascinating. And I hope to tell you more about it as it progresses. Oh, let's see. About 19 minutes before the hour. And have you had enough? No, let's tie this all together real quick. You heard the story of Mr. Kamaz. And, of course, we talked about the fact that the slaughterer from Haditha got the walk. Didn't even have to stand to court-martial. Man, that's some justice. You get the idea that in the military, the lady with the blindfold and the sword and the scales got it all taken away from her, and she got taken out and raped, too. As of Monday, yesterday, the Pentagon announced that it's going to subject a Tanzanian man to a war crimes tribunal for the 1998 East African embassy bombings. Yeah, I know. So what? It's another day in Bushville. There's only one problem. He's already been indicted. Ahmad Gailani was indicted in New York 10 years ago. He was taken into U.S. custody 4 years ago. But the Pentagon won't turn him over to the civil authorities for trial. Did you hear me? The Pentagon will not turn over this man to the United States Department of Justice, who sought and obtained his indictment in New York. I know. That takes a couple of minutes, doesn't it? That's like when the murderer has fled to Brazil and then the U.S. says, you know, we want to... No, I'm sorry, we won't extradite him. See, that's the problem. The Bush administration Pentagon is now acting as a law unto itself. We are closer to a military dictatorship than you probably think, or than even I think, or most people think. Gailani was captured in 2004 in Pakistan and was held by the CIA in a secret detention prison facility until September 2006. The CIA, knowing that he was indicted by the, you know, federal court, still surrendered him only to the U.S. military. The U.S. military transferred him to Guantanamo. Now, of course, let's make it clear here. We're talking about the Bush administration Justice Department. Carol Rosenberg, writing for McClatchy Newspapers, notes that there has been no known effort by the Justice Department to have him transferred to New York to stand trial. And that just drives me nuts. No effort by the Justice Department. No effort by the federal court who holds his indictment. Brigadier General Tom Hartman is the Pentagon's military commission's legal advisor. In other words, he's the guy who comes up with all the gorgeous, immaculate claptrap and BS for these kangaroo courts in Guantanamo. And he's the one who announced the kangaroo court charges yesterday. He said, and I quote, "The President of the United States made a determination that the alleged war crimes that are committed in connection with the Global War on Terror, the GWAT, are going to be tried at the commissions." If the Southern District of New York wants to proceed with a trial process, they can do that. No, General, you dumbass, they can't. They cannot constitutionally try this man in absentia, because at least on paper, we haven't quite descended all the way to tin pot, crackpot, banana republic dictatorship just yet. Not, General Hartman, that you're not trying. The Department of Justice in Washington and the spokesman for Manhattan U.S. Attorney Michael Garcia both declined to comment. Michael Garcia is, of course, a loyal Bushie. The charges against Ahmad Gailani: conspiracy, murder, and providing material support for terror. I don't know how you're going to get the terror under subpoena and bring the terror into court to testify that the terror was materially supported by Gailani. I just don't know how you're going to get a noun to freaking testify. But it's all in regard to the August 7th, 1998 suicide attack at the U.S. Embassy in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. If he is convicted before the military kangaroo court, he stands to receive the rough justice that tends to flow from kangaroo courts. Ahmad Gailani will be subject to execution by the military. He says that he did not conduct surveillance of the U.S. embassies before the attack, but he said that he did help deliver explosives that turned a Nissan pickup truck into a deadly truck bomb. He's already admitted it. At the kangaroo court, he's toast. He might be toast in the federal court, too, because we have a federal death penalty. But there is some little bit of a shred of at least procedural, if not substantive, due process accorded to the man if he is tried according to his indictment. It is a process that is governed by some level of rules-based judicial procedure, unlike the kangaroo courts at Guantanamo, where the rules have just been made up as they go along. You also have to ask yourself, well, you know, why not turn him? Why not try him? Why not put him out in that weird ass prison where, you know, let him be Ted Kaczynski's next door neighbor and the blind sheik, and they can all play, you know, pinochle together for the rest of their lives? Why not? You know why not? Because the man has been tortured. And if he was tried in the federal court system with federal court rules, everything that they dragged out of him in the way of a confession would be likely to be thrown out as fruit of the poisonous tree, as the product of torture. And the Bush administration can't stand that level of embarrassment, because you've got people like General Michael, who looks a hell of a lot like the Chicken Hawk from Warner Brothers cartoon Hayden, out there saying torture has waterboarding has no interest to the CIA anymore. We haven't done it for 5 years. I mean, we quit doing it and stuff. I mean, I don't know why you people keep talking about it. I wants me a rooster. I'm a rootin' tootin' chicken hawk. So that's why he can't be tried in New York. That's why his silence must be enforced by virtue of a trial in front of this dummied-up, ginned-up, faked-up, frauded-up, phonied-up, rubed-up kangaroo court tribunal in Guantanamo. Now, if somebody really wanted to try him in New York, why, there's an obvious remedy. When you have someone under indictment and there is an outstanding warrant for his arrest or detention, something called a capias in many places, all the prosecutor's got to do is file a little old thing called a writ of habeas corpus, known in legal circles as the noble writ, the extraordinary writ, the writ upon which the vast majority of the rest of our freedoms are founded, because as long as you have the writ of habeas corpus available, you can't just get disappeared by the government. All the more reason, then, why we can't have a country that has habeas corpus anymore. You can't be subjected to habeas corpus. He's not an American citizen. Only one problem with that. The habeas corpus ad prosequendum that would be issued on behalf of the people of the United States, who, by extension, are citizens of the United States and do have available to them habeas corpus. All the more good reason for the loyal Bushy at the United States Attorney's Office for the District of Manhattan to dummy up and stay dummied up. It is interesting, out of all of this, that Gailani has made no allegation that he's been tortured or abused. But the Bush administration doesn't know what he's seen and what he's heard, and what impact that may have had on what he said. Hillary Clinton, the story notes, has said she'll seek to have accused terrorists tried in civilian courts. Barack Obama, while less specific, has also questioned the military commission system. And at one point in time, although it's probably changed by now, sort of like the temperature goes up and down on a thermometer, at one point in time, John McCain-Turian candidate pledged to close Guantanamo and move any military commissions to the United States. But he still wants to have the military commissions. He still likes the idea of the kangaroo courts. You know, I'm sorry, you guys. It's been a very, very heavy evening. And sometimes that's just how this stuff works out. I'd given serious consideration to starting out and going all night long and just pretending to be a right-winger as an April Fool's joke, sort of the same way that Mark Levine did. But I didn't have the stomach for it, because, like I said at the beginning, there was just too much earnestly real stuff to get at. Maybe we'll have some fun tomorrow night with prayer meeting, because I've already got a stack of fun prayer meeting stuff. Thanks, everybody, for joining in and participating in whatever way you chose to do so. Email, chat room. Haven't looked, I really can't go and look at the message boards in the fora, but maybe even that way. I can't go there during the show. It's a little too distracting. It's all I can do to just sort of watch the chat roll by a little bit. But we encourage your participation. We encourage your thoughts, your discussion, your dialogue. It's all free. The chat room, headonradionetwork.com, the fora at headonradionetwork.com/forum. You know, just go to headonradionetwork.com and you can get everywhere else. And I hope you will. And I hope those of you who can will help us make it through April. We start April in something on the order of at least $1,000 hole, having pulled up $400 short in March. But as long as we can, we'll keep at it, as long as you evince your desire for us to do so in numerous ways. I'm trying to grow the audience, grow your voices, because the more people who hear the programming hear you and your thoughts. So any help that you choose to give is mightily appreciated. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer. He'll be along later with all foxed up at midnight. Hopefully he'll join me at 11 for a horn section, all times Eastern. Peter Godbold is a rerun yet again, because Peter Godbold, have you ever been in one of those places where no matter how hard you work, stuff keeps going disastrously wrong? That's Peter Godbold's world right now. He's moved on into like kicking furniture. but he hopes to be back tomorrow night if he can just keep the disasters at bay. Thanks to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, who has been so since, God knows, 2002? Saving the idea of liberal talk radio and moving it forward. WhiteRoseSociety.org. He's got a fundraiser going, too. He needs your help. Thanks to all the hardworking people at Coal River Mountain Watch. What amazing people they are. Spending every day saving their communities, saving their state, trying to save their region, and yes, trying to save America, all of which is downstream for the generations to come. CRMW.net. Go by, have a look. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Kids, it's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome. Welcome indeed to book chapter and verse 123 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively here on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch can be found at crmw.net. That's Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. I encourage you to stop by and have a look at what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your today. Today, in fact, being March the 11th. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on March the 11th, you're indeed listening to a live show. And you should feel free to call in and participate. I'll be giving out the toll-free numbers and the toll numbers in just a few minutes. You'll find the show site at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. Excellent. Just checking a note from production. You know, yes, you'll find links there, by the way, to all of the guests. You'll find links to the audio archives from the past shows. You'll find links to the chat room, which is active as I speak. Tonight is a good night to join the chat room if you've not been there before. It is an amazing place with the Internet's smartest and most informed people. There is always a rolling post of all of the shows on the Head On Radio Network there. You'll find posts related to what the hosts are talking about, what the articles are about. You'll find links to the guest sites posted there. A fun place to be. And in fact, if you're listening to any of the shows on Head On Radio Network and not participating in the chat room, you're indeed missing an interesting aspect of the show. Of course, if you're not listening live, you are listening to one of our streams. Many of you listen to these streams on a different time schedule that fits your own, which is, of course, wonderful. We're glad to have you in any way you can participate. And the links to those shows are strictlyconfidentialradio.com. I'm also glad to say that the links are now all fixed and running beautifully over at White Rose Society. So you can find them at White Rose Society with Ben Birch, and who's an asset to this program, and also at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com also to the Head On Radio Network main site, and there you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on this network. I am a very small part of it, but I am glad to be a part of it. You'll find links there also to Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, and there are links to help you locate the music that you